Hello, and welcome to I Am The Egg Pods with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, it's welcome return to friend of the podcast, David Quantick.
Hi, Chris. How's it going?
Awesome. How about
you? Excellent. Yeah, never better. Never better. It's another Beatle-related day. The last thing I saw, Paul McCartney had posted a picture of a wall-inset pillar box, and the world is crazy with excitement.
We've got some stamps on the way, apparently.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Good, because we had Queen, and that was terrible. What's the point of a stamp with Queen on? So it's about time we had Paul and all the Beatles.
Absolutely. First class. So the album that you picked today is the 1978 compilation, Wings Greatest. So why have you picked this one?
I picked it because, A, I really love it. B, I had a little superstition about it for years. Every time I moved flat, which was often in the olden days, whenever I set up my record player, as we called them then, I would always use this record as the first play. I don't know why. It wasn't that good for testing stereo, but I liked it, and it just became a habit. Then, with the age of downloads, I parted company with it. You know, there's so many compilations. Oh, have you got Wingspan? You know, there's not that many compilations, but it sort of became a bit otiose. And I saw it the other day. I don't know. And then I find myself making playlists of Wings' greatest hits. And then in the end, I just thought, sod this. I went to HMV and bought an expensive vinyl copy to replace my original vinyl copy. So this is my, because I've had the CD as well, this is my third Wings' greatest hits.
Really? You'd say about other compilations, I mean, we've got Wingspan, we had All the Best, and the pure McCartney compilations. Why this one in particular?
He's not very well served by compilations, McCartney. I mean, yeah, four, but in solo career since 1970. And Wings' greatest hit, the other ones are great, but they're not greatest hits. Not in the sense that I would make it. They're kind of compilations. A lot of them have got extraneous stuff on. All the Best is all right, but it's not bland, but it's a little bit mainstream. Wings' Greatest Hits is a bit mad, and it sounds like a proper album to me. I really like compilations that sound like mad albums, that have got sequencing that's interesting. This one isn't in chronological order. It doesn't have all the hits on it, caused much outrage at the time and later on.
Yeah.
It picks minor hits over major hits. It runs around in time like a demented Doctor Who, but it works really well. Also, my other reason for loving it is that on the front cover is an Art Nouveau figure, which is legendary in McCartney folklore for many reasons. One reason is, of course, that it was flown to Switzerland for the cover shoot. To Switzerland. And the cover shoot is some snow and a blue sky, which I'm saying could have been done in a freezer. But that was the extravagant... I mean, this is the McCartneys, who apparently once took some chickens to Scotland in a taxi. But at least they were alive. And what I love about this statue is that if you go past MPL, Paul McCartney's headquarters, in Soho Square in London, which I used to live near, you'll see that figurine in an upstairs window. And I love that. It's like a beacon for McCartney fans saying, the world is fine. Look, it's the cover of Wings' greatest hits, minus the snow.
It's also on the Back to the Egg cover as well.
It is. But yeah, it's one of my... Wings' greatest hits is one of my favourite greatest hits albums. It's not that long. It would be a double if it were. It's got a slightly bizarre selection of songs, as though McCartney can't remember. Because in the Barry Miles book, McCartney's great because he gets things mixed up. He goes, I think that song was on Help, or was it Hard Day's Night? I don't know. Yeah. Because the American albums confused him. And it seems to have happened again. There's songs here that weren't singles in Britain, and it's quite rando, which I love. And it's got Mullah Kintyre on it, which is the first single I ever bought and is still one of my favourite records of all time. And Mullah Kintyre isn't on much.
Mm. I think the timing of the release, I find it interesting, and it's something he'd return to later. Because you think this came between London Town and Back to the Egg. So London Town had a bit of a critical panning. Then he released Wings' Greatest. And similarly, after the poor reception for press, then All the Best compilation came out. And I wonder if it's him reaffirming himself to the public and so, you know, look, this is what I've done.
I think so, because to be honest, releasing a compilation 8 years into your career, 5 years, whatever, 7 years into Wings' career, when you've still got two albums to go, is a bit eccentric. It's not one of those moments when you think, right, the train stopped. He didn't go into a hiatus. Greatest hits come out when, you know, the late generally the label are panicking because the artist has gone off to do something else, or they've clearly so high they can't work. Whereas Wings was still a working band and would continue to be for another couple of years. Yeah, I mean, it's clearly tied in to poor sales and lack of focus. But it's nice because, as has often happened with various Beatles, solo or otherwise, it was a great chance to say, you know what, we're great. And Wings, the endless reputation of Wings, the Alan Partridge jokes, the accusations at the time of blandness and suburbanness, which are all drivel. This album just came out and said, up yours, mate. Wings are brilliant.
You think that people had enough of silly love?
Bend on the run, bend on.
A bit flat, mate.
Funny, I only checked him this morning.
Wings' Greatest, out now.
So the album was released on the 22nd of November 1978, and it was actually issued following Paul's decision to leave Capitol in the US and to move to Columbia. And Paul, strangely, was the last of the four Beatles to release a retrospective album. So John and Ringo released their best-ofs in October, November 1975, and George in November 1976. And as you say, yeah, interestingly, some of the singles on here had never been on albums. And I think, like you said, the stockpile of material that he had, for example, Listen to What the Man Said, which was a US number one, didn't even make it.
It's bizarre. I mean, maybe he just thought that, you know, to sell the albums. But yeah, Listen to What the Man Says. Not Helen Wheels isn't here, which is on Band on the Run, but was a British single only. And there's probably others as well. I've got a terrible memory. But yeah, Give Ireland Back to the Irish isn't here. Mary Had a Little Lamb isn't here. You could easily have made this a double. But the thing is, songs that weren't on albums, there's nothing from America, Wings Over America. Maybe I'm amazed one of his greatest songs isn't here, although it should be. So,
yeah.
But, you know, just look at it. You've got records that weren't on albums. Another Day, Live and Let Die. Is Junior's Farm on an album?
No, not originally.
Not originally, there we go. High, 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 but no Sea Moon. Mullachintyre, not properly on an album, no Girls' School here. And Uncle Albert, which is on an album, but wasn't a single in the UK. So it's, and what I love about it is it's not what you call a random record, but again, the sequencing isn't just mad chronologically, it's mad stylistically. You go from Another Day, which is lovely, sweet, very minimal, to Silly Love Songs, which is a full-on disco stomper. Yeah. And Silly Love Songs is one of his greatest ever records, but it's track two on this record. And then it goes mad into Live and Let. I mean, we'll go through this in a minute. But it's an extraordinary collection. And because of all the different Wingses, you could get even more conceptual. You know, even Wings aren't the same band throughout. Sometimes Wings is just Paul. Sometimes it's Paul and Linda. Sometimes it's various people. There's a lot of different Wingses, and they're just chucked in here. I love it. I absolutely love it.
Every day she takes a morning bath, she wets her hair, wraps a towel around her as she's heading for the bedroom chair. It's just another day. Slipping into stockings, stepping into shoes, dipping in the pocket of her raincoat.
So we crack on with the album then, and we start with track one, Another Day.
Another Day. It's was this the debut single?
It was, yes.
The debut solo single. It's that kind of thing where you have to get... When I hear it now, I go, oh, it's a nice song. It could have come out at almost any point in the Beatles' career. It's, you know, classic McCartney character study of a lonely person. And kind of sympathetic, lovely little tune. But I think... Because of the weight of the Beatles, at this point, people were expecting McCartney's single to be something. You know, Lennon had managed to do it. Cold Turkey and Instant Karma had been, you know, big statement singles. Ringo had done pretty well with It Don't Come Easy. No one was expecting anything from Ringo, but he did really well. And George Harrison, you know, like just an elephant pooping gold on the floor. All Things Must Pass. That was what people thought the Beatles solo would be, like the Beatles had been, but bigger. And McCartney, the most talented Beatle, Don't At Me, came out with a really low-key, meek record. So people were out to get him at this point. And if he'd produced, if he'd brought out Maybe I'm Amazed, and if he'd given it a bit of the old Abbey Road production, you know, that would have been a massive kick in the face for everybody. It would have really established him as the king of the 70s. But he was down, you know, he was drinking, he was depressed, he wasn't shaving. You can always tell how Paul's doing by his face. You know, if he's got a cool moustache, he's in a good mood. If he's got a big mullet, he's rocking away. If he's got an unshaven face, he's very unhappy.
Yeah.
So that's how you tell. But yeah, Another Day, not a bad song, not what I'd call a great single. And unfortunately, every time I think of it, I always think of that appalling song, How Do You Sleep, by Lennon. You know, the only thing you did was yesterday, and now something, something, you're just another day. You know, so up yours, John. Wait till you hear Here Today. You'll cry your eyes out. Oh, you can't, because you're dead. So yeah, Another Day, not a bad opener, but it really is just, that pretty much is Paul opening the door, looking round and saying, can I come in?
Yeah, the more you think about it, it's a very strange debut single. To release something like Maybe I'm Amazed as a debut single, would that have then, would he have done like an All Things Must Pass, everybody's suddenly expecting everything after that to be of the same quality? And would he have then dipped like George did, perhaps?
It's hard to say, because Paul's 70s output, as we'll discuss via the medium of this, I propose, is so bizarre until it gets to Band on the Run. It's so bitty and experimental, and there's medleys, and somebody in the Roy, or Tony Tyler in the Beatles Illustrated Record, says Paul McCartney spends a lot more care on his production than the songs merit, as we will see throughout this. But what Americans would have wanted was Abbey Road 2, with Maybe I'm Amazed as the long and winding road standout ballad. They wanted Beatle production, big sound, amazingly good songs, very conventional. They didn't want McCartney 1, as we now have to call it. You know, they didn't want little sketches and demos, home-recorded things. McCartney's head was there. He wasn't feeling great. And also, he's probably still got a bit of the get-back mindset of, you know, getting away from big productions, getting down to it. You know, he's living on his farm. He has many homes, but he chooses... For years, I thought this record was made on his farm. I was quite surprised to discover some of it was done at Abbey Road. Yeah. So, yeah, it's... All in all, it's a very low-key, meek start to a solo career.
And almost a duet in many ways, because Linda's all over this vocal.
Yes, I hadn't thought that, and you're absolutely right. And again, that would have upset a lot of Beatles fans who were used to hearing The Beatles. And, like John, there were many issues with ladies on it. But it's a nice song. It would have been an amazingly good B-side. It would have been a fine album track. But it's obviously... I don't think McCartney at any point thought, this is going to be number one in every country in the world, I'll show you. He was possibly thinking, I've had enough of bloat. You know, you've got two Beatles releasing singles with Phil Spector. So I think that had an effect on him. You know, he didn't want to go the Phil Spector route.
So we move on to track two, Silly Love Songs, released on the 10th of March 1976, reached number two in the UK but hit the top spot in the US.
Well done, America. Oh, God, I love this song. Everything about it is just, for a start, it's the manifesto, you know.
Yeah.
If you had to pick a lyric that summed up Paul McCartney's career, Silly Love Song, what's wrong with that? I forget the exact line now, after all that. Some people say the world has had enough of silly love songs. I say that isn't true. But yeah, it's the manifesto song. It's the Paul McCartney manifesto. Love songs are great. It's in keeping with the times, because what's interesting with Paul in the 70s is that he keeps pace with musical movements. You know, when glam comes along, he releases Hell and Wheels. Yeah. And when disco comes along, he brings out loads of songs, including silly love songs, that fit the mould, but aren't... He doesn't go full disco like Rod Stewart or the Stones. He does something that you can dance to, but fits that world, and it's still a song. Also, there's a thing that's not talked about, which is my theory, his secret 10cc fetish. All through his career, he links up with 10cc in weird ways. He does Mike McCartney's brilliant, brilliant solo album with Wings at Strawberry Studios. He has members of 10cc on it. He uses the gizmo, or a primitive version of Godley and Cream's device. He works later on with Eric Stewart in the solo years. And also on Press to Play, you can hear some brilliant 10cc harmonies that he's obviously, that's why he's got Eric in. I want that. But this song is called Silly Love Songs. It's a 10cc song called Silly Love.
Yeah.
And I think that given, I think Paul followed 10cc sort of in the way that Lennon liked ELO. He kind of liked the idea of someone being a bit beatly. And there's a lot of that lovely production in 10cc. You know, McCartney had better songs, but you can hear the playfulness. Rubber Bullets could be a Wings single, for example, around that time. Yeah. And also what I love about Silly Love Songs is it's got that Pink Floyd style boom ch sound effect start. Tape loop. So I love Silly Love Songs. I would definitely put it in one of my top three McCartney solo songs.
Yeah. And Paul, like you say, Paul, he was blatant. That's what it was about. He said, the song was, in a way, to answer people who just accused me of being soppy. The nice payoff now is that a lot of the people I meet who are at the age where they've just got a couple of kids and have grown up a bit, settled down, they'll say to me, I thought you were really soppy for years, but I get it now. I see what you were doing. And I think that's kind of, you could say that about a lot of Paul's songs.
The thing about Paul McCartney is the thing about country and western, it's the thing about grown-upness. Paul McCartney was the first rock songwriter to say, what is actually wrong with getting married? What's actually wrong with having kids, having a job? What's actually wrong with living in a house? You know, the idea that life is all rebellion, your teens are rebellion, maybe your 20s if you're a musician or a music journalist. But most of us, you know, find fulfillment through traditional love, or just through love, through relationships, through home, stability. McCartney was the first Beatle to write about that. Lennon didn't write about it. Lennon wrote about, you know, obsessive love, you know, his fixation on Yoko. And later on, he wrote songs about his children, his son, and got hammered for it then. You know, people are like, oh, he's turned into a softy. But what's wrong? I found the quote now. Some people want to fill the world with silly love songs. And what's wrong with that? I'd like to know. And then he goes, cause here I go again, which I love. He's just like, I can't stop writing these songs. But yeah, that's the thing about Paul. He was right. That's why somebody goes to see McCartney now or in the 80s, takes their kids, plays the records to them. That's why they realise he was great. Because to be honest, the other Beatles had nothing to offer. Alcoholism, drugs, religion, living in New York. They're all great until you're 24. Except religion, you know, which goes on. But you know what I mean. It's just, Paul was right. Again.
When you were young and your heart was an open book, you used to say, live and let live. You know you did. But if this ever-changing world in which we live in makes you give in and cry, say, live and let die.
Next, recorded during the sessions for Red Rose Speedway and released 6 years to the day after Sgt. Pepper on the 1st of June 1973, it's Live and Let Die.
Wow. When you're growing up in the 70s, it was weird this because it had sort of gone off to soundtrack land. If you wanted it, you had to get like a, you know, the Live and Let Die soundtrack album, which featured such classics as, I don't know, James Bond Running or Cocktail Time. Oh, sorry, we're all supposed to like soundtrack albums now, aren't we? But yeah, Live and Let Die is important in a million ways. Where do we start? It's the reunion with George Martin.
Mm.
First time they'd worked together since Bits of Let It Be, I think. We're right in saying.
Oh, no, it's on Ram. Ram is on.
He's on Ram, okay. He's on Ram, and he's on McCartney 3 as well, which is rather nice.
Yes.
The little song about farming. Lots. But yes, anyway, so Live and Let Die. My first thing to say about it is what I love is it's two 60s legends. It's the Beatles and James Bond. And I always imagine in my head, 1965, if they hadn't gone to Tom Jones or Shirley, if they'd gone to the Beatles, what would a Beatles Bond theme be like? Something off Abbey Road. I mean, something, which Shirley Bassey did. Imagine that as a Bond theme. Of course, they'd have to rename it. Something on Her Majesty's Secret Service by George Harrison and the Beatles. But yeah, it fascinates me that these two... And what's interesting is, you know, in the 60s, you've got the Beatles and Sean Connery. Then in the 70s, it's Roger Moore and Paul McCartney. It's different. But McCartney did such a good job on it. It relates to the film, you know, because McCartney loved Jamaica. So the Caribbean setting, he gets it. He has a reggae break in the middle, which is fantastic. Yes. He gets the drama of Bond. He gets the, you know, he gets the John Barry, Monty. I interviewed John Barry once, and I asked him about the, before the court case, the Monty Norman, John Barry thing. And all he said was, I'll only say this to you. Can you name me anything else that Mr. Norman has written of note?
It's like,
okay. And you can't really go, well, what about the Calypso theme from Dr. No? Yeah. That's a... So, yeah. So Paul McCartney gets Bond. He gets John Barry. And this is where it's all coming back together that, you know, he'd written, as I said, for several years, these bitty little songs, these medleys, these snatches of tune and lovely productions that started somewhere and went somewhere else. But with Live and Let Die, is the first time he sits down and goes, I'm Paul McCartney. I'm the best songwriter in the world. Songs are like verse, verse, chorus, bridge, that sort of thing, riff. Mm. And not only does he do that, not only does he write a brilliant rock pop song, you know, the Paul McCartney song, the Wings song that's covered by Guns N' Roses, Up Yours, Alan Partridge, a proper rock song. But it's insane because it's more Bond than Bond. He just goes, what does James Bond have? Sex and explosions. Bang! It's very significant. When he does it live, it's always with the firework display.
Yeah.
I feel quite alarmed for him, seeing this bloke sat on stage surrounded by bombs. But Live and Let Die, after what's gone before, after the stuff on Red Rose Speedway and Ram, to release this, it's from nowhere. I mean, it isn't from nowhere because it's from the man who did Abbey Road and the man who did Sgt. Pepper and so on and so forth. It's like a successor to get to Back in the USSR or something. But it's an insane, and it's confident. The thing people talk about McCartney is he lost his nerve. He stopped being Beatle Paul, who could do anything, who could just phone somebody up and say, I want a million sparrows in a pie instead of a drum kit on this. I'll phone up, you know, Alfred Hitchcock and ask him to look at my home movies, whatever. That Paul's gone. This is, you know, we've had Paul shuffling about his farm, wondering if anyone likes him, because, you know, everyone hates him and loves the Beatles. And he just comes back with this. He's like confident enough to work with George Martin so that, you know, there's no, oh, who's the fifth Beatle? He just is.
Yeah.
I think it's because it's a job. I think it's because it's a commission. Instead of sitting there worrying about himself and going, can I do this? He's just like, oh, I can do that. James Bond theme.
Because exactly, Cubby Broccoli approached Paul because John Barry wasn't available. And oddly enough, he also approached Paul to write the theme for Diamonds Are Forever.
Cool.
Which didn't happen. What that would have been like, I don't know.
It would have been good, but, you know, not Live and Let Die.
Paul's quote, this is just exactly what you say. I read the Live and Let Die book in one day, started writing it that evening, carried on the next day and finished it by the next evening. I sat down at the piano, worked something out, and then got in touch with George Martin, who produced it with us. Linda wrote the middle reggae bit of the song. We rehearsed it as a band, recorded it, and then left it up to him. And that was it.
Amazing. Amazing. And it's fantastic. And it's a one-off single. And I'm sure that helped too. You know, I think if it had been part of an album. And I also think it gives him a boost for Band on the Run. Because before Live and Let Die, there's nothing that sounds like Live and Let Die. After it, Band on the Run and Live and Let Die, you know, Live and Let Die could have been on the Band on the Run album. quite easily, side two opener.
Yeah, yeah. George, oddly enough, George Martin took a demo of the recording to Harry Saltzman during the filming, and apparently Harry suggested that it be sung by Thelma Houston, but George insisted on Paul. So,
oh, that's good.
Yeah, it took a lot to impress him.
That's good. I'm glad that he's still batting for Paul after all they've been through. I mean, Thelma Houston would have been great, but what's great about this, it's one of the very few Bond themes that are entirely written, performed by the artist. There isn't even a John Barry credit. It was A-ha John Barry hated. I think because A-ha really wanted to do the song themselves. And, you know, most of them were John Barry credited with whichever old hack was limping around at the time. Duran Duran, some rubbish like that. But yeah, Live and Let Die, it's probably the best Bond theme, not by someone called Shirley, but it's an incredible record. It's certainly one of the best Wings records, and it's certainly one of the best Beatles solo records. Oh, you should have seen me.
Next, a song recorded in Nashville and released on the 25th of October 1974, Junior's Farm.
Oh, I love Junior's Farm. It's a proper single, as we said, not on an album, again. It's unusual for Wings because he didn't do a lot of rockers, but this is a proper kick-ass rocker. It's got fantastic guitar in the kind of glam Mick Ronson style. It's a real rocker. It's funny in loads of ways because it relates to Helen Wheels in that, you know, their vehicle, their Land Rover, that idea of getting back to the country, but it's by no means a country song. You know, it's a very urban, punch the air stadium rocker. It's one of the few semi-topical songs that he's written. There's one on, apart from Give Ireland Back to the Irish, and there's that one on Egypt Station about the ship sinking, which is clearly about Trump. Yeah. But this one, it's got, everybody's talking about the president, we all chipped in for a bag of cement, so that's an anti-Nixon line, I believe. And I took my bag into a grocer's store, price is higher than time before, that's about Ted Heath and inflation, Ted Heath known as Grocer Heath. So it is kind of, it's a song about getting away, but it's more about getting away from the political situation, inflation, all that kind of thing. And then there's a load of nonsense about Eskimos. Eskimos crop up quite a lot in McCartney lyrics. There's an Eskimo song on McCartney 3. I think he just likes the word. Just proof that he's not in wit for the money.
Oh, really?
I know, terrible. Yeah, it's a brilliant, brilliant single. It's one of those things that the Beatles used to do so well. Let's just bung out a single. It's wonderful. It's a real kick-ass little rocker. I hate saying that, and I've said it twice now. And there's not much to say about it. Like all great singles, it's self-contained. It fit perfectly on the... I've always maintained this. When you go to a disco and it's like a 60s night, they never put on Beatles songs because they stand out too much.
Yes.
You know, it's like a birthday cake with a Shakespeare quote on. It's a bit too much. But in the 70s, Paul, more than anyone apart from Ringo, discovered the art of fitting in on the radio. So when you turn on the radio, you didn't go, oh, it's the Beatles. Well, everything stopped. Everyone sit down. You go, oh, this is great. The new one from Wings fits in with T-Rex and Roxy Music, fits in with 10cc and whoever. Yeah. He discovered, to put the Beatles to one side.
Also, this is, I think, part of the sound for me is it's Jimmy McCulloch's debut.
Yes. Oh, is it?
Which really brings an edge.
Yeah, I mean, there's that great tension with Jimmy McCulloch that, you know, he always wanted to be, you know, in a rock band, in a real roots band, and he wasn't. And he probably wanted to do his own thing more, but he wasn't allowed to. But here is perfect. You know, I mean, McCartney's not going to put a searing guitar solo on silly love songs, but it works here, and he's perfect on it, and he's fantastic on it. And I can still remember, we'll come on to it in a second, but I remember something, and I'll tell you about it with the next song. Thank you.
did talk about With a Little Luck when you did London Town, so I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I'll probably just repeat myself, more. But all I want to say about With a Little Luck was I saw it on Top of the Pops with a little film that was shown, and I remember having this, I may have said this before, but I remember having this sudden flash realisation that this was Paul from the Beatles, which is odd because I knew about, I had Mullock and Tyre already, but it was like, that's Paul from the Beatles. And it just, suddenly it all came, like 2001, a massive stream of rainbow lights into my brain. Bang! Paul McCartney is still great. But I love, I've talked about it before, you're right, but I love With a Little Luck. It's the most recent song on this record and brings things up to date. And it's just there. And where's I've Had Enough, eh? Why isn't that on here?
Yeah. And again, it's another one that would fit perfectly on the radio at the time.
With a little, well, there's the famous story, everyone says, Elvis Costello, you know, when he's working with McCartney later, he said, when I was touring America, it was a hell musically listening to the radio, but then Wings would come on, songs like With a Little Luck, and yeah, he knew how to make records that would be played in America, but they were so much better than American radio deserved. They were not drivel like the Eagles.
And again, what you said about the track listing, so you've got Live and Let Die, this hugely powerful orchestral piece, then Junior's Farm, which is a raw rocker, and then this, which is kind of AOR, FM, smooth music. It's could be three different bands. I wonder if that was the point of this, the track listing, to highlight how diverse they were.
That would be an interesting point of view, because, yeah, you go from Another Day, Meek, to Disco, Silly Love Songs, to Epic, Cinematic Live and Let Die, rocker. There's every kind of mood here. And the side ends with the famous opening track.
Stuck inside these four walls, sent inside forever, never seeing no one nice again like you.
So next we have Band on the Run.
Band on the Run, a song which opens the album of its name and closes side one of this. It kind of works because With a Little Luck kind of fades out and gets a bit moody. And then Band on the Run comes in a bit moody. Band on the Run is best discussed in the context of itself. But again, follows Live and Let Die. It's everything I said about Live and Let Die. It's the confidence one. You'd be unsurprised if it had been produced by George Martin, which it isn't. Everything here is McCartney, it says, apart from Live and Let Die. Band on the Run's a great song with nonsense lyrics. It's the one that's been said so many times. The way it copied Sgt. Pepper with its reprise, with its band theme, with its mystical nonsense lyrics, but also with its massive kick in the arse confidence. He said, I'm going to do a song with an instrumental start, moody first verse, a massive Tony Visconti, you know, arranged second introduction, and then straight into an Eagles-style acoustic rocker, though we didn't know or care about the Eagles then. And also, for no apparent reason, a throwback lyric to Helen Wheels about Sailor Sam and the Jailer Man.
Well, there's all sorts of inspiration. There's all sorts of theories as well. I mean, some say it was about the partly inspired by the drugs busts of the late 60s and that kind of desperado thing. And also, If We Ever Get Out of Here, was George Harrison said that during an Apple board meeting.
Oh, yeah.
But I think the main thing was the parting of the ways with Alan Klein.
Right.
Which gives it a whole sort of freedom, the band on the run. They were all released from those times.
Right. That makes sense. And also there's the Disney thing. There's that film, what's it, The Living World, The Natural... I should look it up. But it's a beautiful early wildlife film featuring little desert creatures. And McCartney just puts the whole film in a couple of lines. Around about, you know, the rain exploded with a mighty crash and all, which is a great line. It's a brilliant song, Band on the Run. And again, it's him just going like, oh, you want the Beatles, do you? I'll do something better.
Well, each section, I mean, they're clearly fragments of different songs, but each one of these is absolutely beautiful. And if he developed each section, so stuck inside these four walls, if he'd kept that going as one long song, probably would have got a bit boring after a while because it wouldn't really go anywhere. It needed that. If We Ever Get Out of Here.
I hadn't thought of it that way. But yeah, I mean, he put together one song, because it's infuriating when you listen to stuff like Little Lamb, Dragonfly and Single Pigeon. And I love Little Lamb. Yeah, if he'd put these flipping things into songs, if he'd done three verses, three choruses, whatever, you know, these albums like Ram and Red Rose Speedway would be brilliant. But he lost interest. He's like, I've done that. Do you get the idea? It's like, we want more. You know, with She Loves You, he didn't go, you think you've lost your love? Well, tough. You know, he carried on. And Band on the Run, yeah. I'd never thought of this, but you're absolutely right. He gets all these fragments and he makes one song out of them. Maybe Hell and Wheels was a bit of this song as well. Maybe that's why it's got those lyrics. Who knows? But he put these three or four chunks together and said, this is one song. It's not medley, Band on the Run, stroke Sailor Sam, stroke Four Walls. Yeah. It's Band on the Run.
We're so sorry, Uncle Albert. We're so sorry if we caused you any pain. We're so sorry, Uncle Albert. There's no one left at home, and I believe I'm gonna rain.
So flipping over to side two, and another song that's constructed from several pieces, is Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey, which wasn't released in the UK, but it was a Grammy Award-winning US-only single, which reached number one in 1971.
Bloody
why
hell.
Why didn't he release this in the UK?
Who knows? How bizarre. I mean, I can see why the Americans liked it, because I've got to contradict everything I've said and say, this is his Abbey Road song. This is completely back to Abbey Road and Pepper. It's weird because it's 1967 whimsy, you know, all dressing up in Victorian uniforms and lyrics about pies. And it's full on Abbey Road, Sergeant Pepper, Magical Mystery Tour, whimsy. You know, you could fit that song on any of those three albums quite happily. It stands out a bit on Ram, which is basically a collection of sort of boogies and jams, by and large. Ram's got that nice down-home feel. I can see why the Americans liked it. It's a proto-FM radio song. It's the kind of thing that, you know, Americans used to have that thing where their charts weren't done by sales. They were done by airplay, which is why the FM charts were so disgusting, because they were just this bland slop of Eagles drivel. So I can see, you know, Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey, while it's lovely, it's not a single in any sense, real sense of the word. And that's why it works on Thrillington. My theory is that Thrillington, you know, the Percy Thrillington instrumental album, which is wonderful, he just thought, you know what, an instrumental version of Uncle Albert would be great. But he couldn't let it lie. So you've got, why do we need an instrumental version of Backseat of My Car? But yeah, Uncle Albert, Admiral Halsey is a very odd choice of song. He probably didn't bring it out in Britain because he didn't want the English people to know about it.
I genuinely don't get my head around it. Mentioning Sergeant Pepper as well. So you've got the sound effects, so you've got thunderstorms, rain, and Paul's telephone impression. And then he also does something he does quite a few times, his Barker voice. And we're so easily called away, which he often throws into songs.
Oh, yeah, that's nice. And then there's the spoken bit of conversion, the butter and the pie. Because there's an awful lot with wings of pie. Monty Python's got a lot to answer for in terms of musicians being funny. There's an awful lot of Gumby voices. There's a terrible advert for some Wings album with Linda going, oh, look at all the little people, or something like that. Oh, God. When they're being the common people, it could be a bit gammy. And it's all here. Yeah. And then it ends with the hands across the water thing, which is a fantastic chorus in search of a song.
Yeah, it's a chant. It's a football chant. So catchy. And then the final twee baby voice, little beer gypsy, get around.
Oh, yeah, I forgot. Yeah, it's almost completely random. It is four or five bits of melody stuck together. It does give that suggestion that it simultaneously Paul McCartney doesn't know what he's doing anymore, but also he doesn't think it matters. Because one thing we learn from the Beatles is they're giving all these interviews at the end going, didn't matter, you know, people would read, we write a load of rubbish, people would read stuff into it. We'd do some nonsense and Charles Manson would go out and do something appalling. So it seemed to them that, you know, they were divorced from the consequences of their actions. And that is Admiral Halsey in a nutshell. It is divorced from the consequences of its actions.
but it's a genuinely beautiful piece of music.
It's lovely.
And for me, it's the same concept as Band on the Run, but because some of the different sections jar so much, I actually like that. I prefer that because it's just makes it, I don't want to use the word quirky, but I have. But for me, it fits perfectly on Ram for that reason.
Right. It's quirky, all right.
Next, released on the 1st of December 1972, immediately banned by the BBC, it's Hi Hi Hi.
This is from the McCartney golden era of Still Cannot Get a Break. Everything he does, people mock him for it, you know, kick him while he's down. He produces, to me, this is probably the archetypal early Wings song, early 70s. It's a brilliant little rocker. It's catchy. It fits in with the glam rock theme. It's a great tune, a little bit of a rock song, perfect pop, and it's banned for drug references. And I think Give Ireland Back to the Irish is banned around this time as well.
Yeah.
Leading to the Mary Had a Little Lamb theory.
Two singles in the same year were banned.
Sorry?
He had two singles in 72 that were banned.
And it wasn't like the Beatles days where, you know, you get into trouble and then somebody would write a New York Times leader saying, leave Paul McCartney alone. This point people are like, yeah, you wanker, you deserve it. So it was a very difficult time. It's like, you know, it's an innocuous pop song. Obviously, it's about drugs. You know, we all know Paul McCartney is pretty much the ambassador for marijuana in the 1970s. I think that's understood. But it's a great tune. It's got a great B-side, Sea Moon, also not included here.
Yeah.
Very sweet bit of McCartney slang.
Which was always on the radio.
Really?
Yeah, I remember once, that's one of my earliest memories, was hearing Sea Moon. I just remember every time I got out of bed, it was being played somewhere.
I love Sea Moon because he's done a lot of reggae that's not, doesn't sound authentic. But what I love about Sea Moon is it's not a reggae song, but it's everything else about it is reggae. It's got a bit of dub in it, a bit of echo. It's like a dub. Sea Moon is like the dub of a song that never existed. And it's a beautiful piece of music, and it was a B-side or a double A-side. So, yeah. Kudos for Hi Hi Hi, a song that he has, shall we say, revisited a few times in his career in different forms. But it's brilliant. It deserved to have had airplay, and basically everyone at the BBC should have been made to eat marijuana and apologise.
Well, it didn't actually. I think that might have helped it because it still hit number 5 in the charts.
Yeah.
But apparently the BBC, it wasn't just the drugs, it was also the sexual reference. Apparently there was a line they picked out, get you ready for my body gun, which Paul claimed was actually get you ready for my polygon. Although he did add, but I suppose it is a bit of a dirty song, if sex is dirty and naughty. I was in a sensuous mood in Spain when I wrote it.
There is a strand of sensuous Paul McCartney songs, it has to be said. No, it's a great song. I can see why the BBC banned it. But it's one of those things that, you know, he's a pop act who's banned. So he's not going to get on John Peel. You know, John Peel's not going to go, well, BBC won't allow this play during the hours of 9 and 10, but I'm unable to. You know, because John Peel's not going to play Hi Hi Hi. So he's a bit stuck. And, you know, he can't do Top of the Pops. And Top of the Pops has become his go-to location now. So, and there's the dog. He's seen something in his mind.
Next we have another song from Wings at the Speed of Sound, released on the 23rd of July 1976, Let 'Em In.
Oh, I love Let 'Em In. It's, you know, it's a great, great lyric. One of those classic McCartney reference ones is everybody in the world, isn't it? From family members to legends of 1960s politics. It's the classic McCartney positivism, acceptance. Let 'em in. Why not? What's wrong with you? You know, come round, let's have a party. I've always imagined this song with McCartney at a pub piano, like in the James Paul McCartney special, with loads of guests arriving, just going, come in, have a drink, have some spliff, not you, Mr. BBC man. Let's have Martin Luther King. Have you met my Auntie Jin? You'll love her. You know, the Billy Paul cover is a rare example of a cover that's almost as good as the original and gives it a different spin with its more political lyric. It's a nice flagship for the underrated Wings at the Speed of Sound, which was seen at the time as a real low point for Wings, you know, the family-orientated group. But it's an album which has got a load of brilliant songs on it. Mm. Yeah, it's kind of weird, the Wings at the Speed of Sound era, because you've had Band on the Run, and then you've had the classic bit like the previous album of Venus and Mars. Where's the singles from Venus and Mars on here? What are the singles from Venus and Mars? Venus and Mars and...
Rock Show, Letting Go.
Letting Go.
Yes, that's what the man said.
Yeah, I mean, Letting Go is a very weird song. It's one of the classic Paul McCartney let songs. He likes let songs.
Yes.
Yeah, Letting Go is weird. It's kind of moody and a bit intense. But yeah, Let 'Em In. And again, we're going from a rocker to a kind of disco-esque song. But it works. You know, they've both got the same kind of spirit of optimism and breeziness. Let 'Em In's one of those songs, the moment you hear the doorbell at the start, you're like, oh, fantastic, Let 'Em In.
Yeah, which was Friedland Westminster Chime doorbell, just so you know.
I knew but that, I think I didn't.
I think what I love about it is you can almost imagine him composing it, just noodling around and getting that little piano, bum, 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 and the way the chords move around. You get a lot of demos of Paul's where he is doing all these noodles that just go on and on, repeating the same thing over and over again. But by adding in the Sister Susie section, it suddenly flowers, it blooms into this song. And it's lyrically, it could be seen as slight, but I think there's a lot in there, actually.
Yeah, I don't think it's...
If you read deep into what was going on into his life.
It's a Liszt song, but... And he can knock those off, as we know. But it's a Liszt song with a little point to it. I absolutely... And also, it's his brass era. You know, it's around the time of the Wings Over America tour, when he's travelling with Howie Casey in the brass section. By the general rule, with Paul McCartney's Red Sky at Night, if Paul McCartney's got a brass section, you're going to be all right. That's what I think, anyway.
Yeah. Kate Robbins was on before. She was saying Sister Susie apparently was the family joke name for Auntie Millie, who was Auntie Jin's older sister.
Okay. It's good to know that.
And also, I love... There's the Uncle Ernie, because Ringo was playing Uncle Ernie at the time. And also, you've got Brother John... But that could be about Linda's brother, who's called John. But you can't help but think it's a double meaning.
Could be getting on with each other again. It could just be, I think, a nursery rhyme. But yeah, it's all there. It's all there. And when I go away, I know my heart can stay with my love. It's understood. It's in the hands of my love, and my love does it good. My love does it good.
Next, recorded at Abbey Road for Red Rose Speedway. Released on the 23rd of March 1973, My Love.
I always associate this song with the cover here because it's a beautifully lit, soft focus, colourful, shiny image with a lovely flower in Paul's mouth. I love My Love. It's kind of the not as good follow-up to Maybe I'm Amazed. It's like he's aiming for Maybe I'm Amazed 2, and he falls short, but he's Paul McCartney. So him falling short is us getting stuck on top of a mountain, pretty much.
Yeah.
It's I think, criticised at the time for being soft by idiots. And it's a beautiful song. Could have easily have fitted on a late period Beatles album. And it's famous for the great guitar bit, which, you know, the cliche is, cuts through the softness. It doesn't, but it adds a different dimension. It's got the full-on, it's in the James Paul McCartney special, it's got the full-on orchestra playing a deliberately soupy kind of orchestral sound, very against the minimalism of the Beatles string sections. George wouldn't have liked this. And then it goes into this beautiful, slightly grungy, slightly sweet guitar break, which really takes the song in a different direction. And again, it's classic McCartney. There's no irony, there's no sort of undercutting. Is I love someone, my love does it good, probably a sexual reference, let's not go there today. Yeah, it's just classic McCartney. It's beautiful. And again, like many of the songs on the albums at this time, it sounds nothing like the rest of the record. Buying Red Rose Speedway on the strength of My Love will lead to nothing but tears and disappointment.
David. But this, I mean, this, Paul said, had been written very early on in his relationship with Linda, so it could date back as far as 69.
Oh, 70. Interesting.
So it might have been, you know, and then you sit on that song like that for another 3-4 years.
You're probably surreal. Just thinking, well, you know, I've still got to get Let It Be out there and maybe I'm amazed.
Well, yeah. And the orchestral arrangement I find quite interesting because it was done by Richard Hewson, who'd previously worked on the Let It Be album, notably The Long and Winding Road.
Oh, how interesting.
So it's strange that Paul chose him.
Well, I think it, presumably his loathing of Spectre did not extend to, you know, everybody else. He probably thought, hey, it's just Phil. But yeah, I would imagine Richard Hewson was probably going, right, what I'm going to do on this is what we did on the Long and anyway, never mind that.
Yeah.
Didn't Richard Hewson do Thrillington as well?
He did, and then he also did the Ra Band.
Is he? Oh, with Richard Hewson, R-A-H, yeah.
Yeah, Clouds Across the Moon.
I always get that mixed up with Son of My Father, but yeah, the Ra Band, very critically acclaimed for a disco act. Cool. So yeah, my love.
I think it's, as you say, Paul's never really holds back on love songs, and I think this is just one of the most beautiful songs, love songs that he's written. It's pure love.
It's absolutely fantastic. I rate it very high. Yeah, and it is just a testament to McCartney power that if it hadn't been written by the man who wrote Maybe I'm Amazed, you know, we'd be unreservedly shouting its praises. Well, you are, yeah. But I'm not. But yeah, it's great.
Released on the 15th of February 1974, recorded at Abbey Road following Wings' return from Lagos, it's Jet.
Yeah, who doesn't love Jet? What an incredible, insane single. It's, my theory has always been that the Jet actually refers to Suffragette, as in Suffragette City, because to me it sounds like a Ziggy Stardust, Aladdin Sane era rocker. And I think it's Paul doing his Spiders from Mars song. It's got that great chugging guitar. It's a brilliant song. He's got so many, because he knows how to write singles in the 70s, which is basically terrace anthems. You know, the shout, Jet. I mean, what a chorus, Jet. You know, a one word chorus. Allegedly, it's about one of his dogs. Again, you know, if you want to Paul McCartney's dogs, relax. Someone will write a song about you and it'll be Paul. The classic sort of nonsense lyrics about sergeant majors. Possibly people have said it's about race again. Who knows? No, it's a brilliant song. And Jet is a great title for a song.
Mm.
It's just great.
Interesting you say about that, because Paul originally said, yeah, it was named after his Labrador puppy. But in 2010, he's said, no, it's about my pony. And just how he, you know, how that is so different, it just makes me think that a lot of Beatles history gets messed up by taking quotes from Paul, George or Ringo, whoever, as they get older.
Yeah.
And they take that as fact. And there's a lot of stuff getting distorted now, I think, with some of these quotes. There was an interview with Paul the other day, and he couldn't remember what year Revolver came out or something. And you think, well, you ain't going to remember, you know, if you played bass on this particular song or not, or sang that particular section. So it's difficult for authors these days, I think.
It is difficult, especially on a different topic. I mean, I notice a lot of revisionism now, and I don't mean by the people who were there. I mean the people who weren't there. There's an awful lot of, as will happen, people going, well, the Beatles were probably thinking about this. It's like, you could always look it up. You know, that's always going to be the valuable thing about Mark Lewisohn, that, you know, he will find the piece of paper. And there is just this kind of thing of like, well, I expect John Lennon sounds like he'd been watching Doctor Who that night, but he lived in America, all this kind of thing. So, yeah, memories shift, and Paul McCartney's memory is likely to be entirely unreliable too. I find it very odd that he had both a Labrador puppy and a pony called Jet. I just presume that was the spliff. He's brought, should we call it Jet?
Well,
but it's a white pony. Jets are white. My theory, anyway. But yeah,
he's probably had about 15 pets called Jet.
Yeah, maybe he does. My grandmother called all her Pekingese dogs Ming. But that's neither here nor there.
Sorry, that reminds me of my mum. We had a series of Labradors, and they were all called Mac.
That's bizarre. Mac, still, why not? At least you're never going to forget his name and save a lot of money on collars. Okay, before we take Mac away, can we just have his little silver disc, please? There you go, puppy. What's this?
It's a bit big for you.
My very own silver disc with my name on.
Right. Have you got any more on the song, Jet?
No, I'm sure it's been discussed by many people. I love that little reggae, chunky reggae bit at the start. It's just such an intense record. It does sound like a Jet. It sounds like a jumbo jet coming to get you. And again, it's interesting that McCartney had noodled about, but when he comes back in full swing in 73, he's writing stadium songs, as they would later be called.
Yeah.
These songs are the big air punchers in his set now. You know, when people play when he plays the Beatles songs, people love it, but they're kind of thinking, I'm hearing a Beatles song by a Beatle. But when he plays these songs, Jet and Live and Let Die, you are, even if you've never heard it, you are swept up. He's invented stadium rock. Let's make that claim. He invents stadium rock with these songs.
I guess because you think this 1972 tour with Wings, that was the first time he'd been on tour, really, where people were listening to the songs. And, you know, the Beatles gigs, you know, even in the early days, people were probably going to dance.
Yeah.
Maybe a bit in the Cavern.
It was drinking in Hamburg, dancing a bit. But also, you think 1972, I mean, I've heard a lot of those tapes. It's a shambles, if we're honest. There's like Henry McCulloch does a 9-minute blues, a slow blues.
Oh, yeah.
Then there's bits of things here and there. Not a great deal of great songs. And then a year and a half later, bang!
Yeah. But maybe that tour, he was getting an idea of what worked and what didn't. So he's writing songs knowing that, this would sound good live. That's where the confidence came from, perhaps.
Well, that could be it, because... And also, fortunately, in a way, he doesn't have that deference from the crowd. You know, they still love him because he's Beatle Paul, but people aren't happy with Paul. It's not like Lennon playing in New York where everybody loves him and everyone's up his bum and, you know, everything is a statement. McCartney goes on stage, people are like, oh, it's that wanker who left the Beatles. Oh, Mary Had a Little Lamb. Come on. This point, Paul can't put a foot right, so it makes sense that when he goes on stage, he's learning from the audience. I like that theory.
Paul of Kintyre, only strolling in from the sea. My desire is on.
We finish with track 6 on side 2, released on the 11th of November 1977, a double A side with Girls' School, number 1 for 9 weeks in the UK, the first single to sell more than 2 million copies, Mull of Kintyre.
Wow. I mean, I keep saying wow a lot. I love this song so much. It just came at a time in my life when I didn't know anything about music, when I kind of liked a lot of old-fashioned stuff because I really just only had my parents' record collection to listen to. I didn't know anything about the new punk sounds or anything, really. So I just thought this was a great song. I still do. I love the tune. I love the sentiment. It's a perfect one-off single. You know, wouldn't have fit on London Town, even though there's a bit of fake folk on that record from sitting around on yachts all day. It's got a great B-side, but it's just... there's demos of it, and what I love is you can hear McCartney singing, doing a different voice, a bagpipe voice. On this, he's going, Mull-kin-tyre. He's singing in a kind of drone. You know, he's anticipating the bagpipes. It's a perfect folk pastiche. Denny Lane wrote some of it. I think he wrote the kind of Miss Rolling Hills in Over the Hills or whatever it is sections.
Yeah.
I love it, and it's never interested me or bothered me that it got mocked because it's a great song. It's one of those, again, there's not much to say about it. It just is what it is. The pipe section works. I like bagpipes. It's got a suitably contrasting B-side. Girls' School is a great, very unusual, razor-sharp McCartney rocker about porn magazines, I believe I'm right in saying.
Yes.
It was the American single. Yeah.
Which did nothing over there.
Did nothing over there. They should have just gone with Mull-kin Tyre and got the rednecks in. Now, and also, it's just, what I like is right at the end of this record, again, it's like, there we go, the biggest selling single of all time, apart from one by the Beatles, which was me anyway. If you don't like this record, tough. And everybody liked this record. Everybody bought it.
It baffles me, really, because... I think its success, you know, being number one for 9 weeks, I remember as a kid as well, it was just constantly on the radio and Mike Yarwood show and all this kind of thing. It was always there. And I seem to remember the longer it was there, the conversations at school, oh man, is it still number one? And then, of course, the following year, you had all the new wave stuff coming through, which was, even for kids, would have changed everything. So it sort of... went out of fashion during its stint at number one.
Well, it didn't. It was from nowhere, you know. And then there was the granny vote, because, you know, Top of the Pops and Radio One were light entertainment, so you'd had all the numerous Saint This and That choirs and nonsense like that. But yeah, it was at the height of disco as well as the so-called height of punk. Yeah, but New Wave came along, as you say, 78, 79. So it was a bit early for all that. But it's a wonderful song from nowhere. And it's kind of only Paul McCartney could have done it and made it great. If it had been the Furies, God bless them, or, you know, Tom Jones, it would have been embarrassing. But I can understand that you sat there with your radio. Those chords are so slow. It's like, and it number one. And it's like, ding, ding. Everyone just goes, oh, God. Ding, yeah. Like your granny shuffling into a room. Which is how we came in, with Paul opening the gate. But... no.
Yeah.
What a single. 2 million copies. What an album.
I love the fact that it was released in the duration of Wings' career. So there's still more stuff. You know, you could have had Good Night Tonight, the following year would have been on it, things like that. But overall, what would you say to people? Why would you say pick this album over maybe other compilations?
I'd say because it's a brilliant album. Yeah, as I said, the tone of all the best... is great. There's nothing wrong with it, but there's no fat here. There's no dross to my mind. It's a beautifully well chosen set of songs and singles, and it has a lot of comfort. It doesn't follow chronology. It just has its own logic, and it's, to me, it's an album. It's like going, okay, you remember those Beatles records when you'd go from rock and roll to moody to soul to psychedelic? It's like that. It goes from rock to disco to folk to pop. It's a primer. To me, greatest hits albums aren't for like people who don't like a band and just want the singles. To me, these are ways in. This is Wingspan was meant to be a way in, but it was too big. Pure McCartney was meant to be, you know, deep cuts. And All the Best was kind of for people who don't like Paul McCartney. It was actually for Alan Partridge. But Wings Greatest is an album that, like the Red and the Blue ones, opens the gates, makes you want to find out more. And, you know, I think I had no Wings records apart from Mull-kin-tyre when I bought this. So... I went in. It's like I went into all the existing Wings albums, of which there were quite a lot at this point in history. And yeah, it does have the effect that Back to the Egg is kind of tacked on.
Well, David Kruntzick, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Chris. I had a great time. Hey!